Back in 2007, at a flea market in Springfield, Tennessee, a woman found a yellow cloth sack. On the sack, hand-stitched in red and green needlepoint, was the story of a woman named Rose and her daughter Ashley. They were both slaves, and when Ashley was 9, she was separated from her mom Rose and sold in South Carolina. The sack was a gift from Rose to Ashley, and the stitching included a signature of Ruth Middleton, the granddaughter of Ashley, and the year 1921. That stitching was all anyone knew about Rose and Ashley and Ruth Middleton. But then, Central Washington University's Mark Auslander began investigating.
The first thing I thought about was, well, Rose is a very common name, and one of the most common names of all enslaved women in the 1800s. Ashley's one of the very rarest. So that seemed a little bit interesting. Also was interesting, if you look at the wording of the sack, which says that Ashley was sold away from her mother as a 9-year-old girl in South Carolina, that needlework suggests that probably Ruth Middleton, when she was embroidering this sack, did not, in fact, live in South Carolina. Because if you lived in South Carolina, you'd say, well, this happened over in Fairfield County, or this happened in Edgefield, or this happened in Columbia. You wouldn't say in South Carolina.
So that, like, geographic specificity was missing?
So, which suggests that this was probably what we call a great migration story. Starting, of course, around the time of World War I, so many African Americans left the South, came north, Chicago, Detroit, or up the eastern seaboard, and eventually, of course, came out here to Puget Sound. And at that point, certain kinds of stories would be forgotten, but others would be passed on. This seemed like a great migration story. So that was a hint, too. So I began to look both for Ruth Middleton's, who plausibly could have been in the North, as well as looking at old slavery records of Rose and Ashley.
And I want to just be clear for listeners who don't know, Rose and Ashley are the two women whose names are on the sack. They were both slaves. Mm-hmm. Ruth Middleton was their ancestor. She was not a slave. She was the one who embroidered their names on this sack. So what did you learn in trying to combine Ashley's name, an uncommon slave name, with Rose, a common slave name, and looking for where they were in South Carolina? What did you find out?
The knowing that there was a 9-year-old who had been sold, as tragic as it is, that gives us a hint. It seemed most likely that that would have happened. I mean, of course, sometimes children were sold ordinarily, but usually they were sold with their mothers. But special sales like that usually happened at estate sales after the death of a major slave owner. And from the standpoint of us as historians, that's in a sense a good thing. It's a horrible thing that happened. But it means that there are probably estate records, or a good chance, because so many aspects of the lives of enslaved people cannot be recovered. But if they show up in court-ordered records to do with estates, that would be a good thing. So I began to go through thousands and thousands of estate records. Some of those are online. A lot of them are only available in the South Carolina archives, or in some cases in courthouses through rural South Carolina. So I looked at a lot of slave records. And at first I thought I'd maybe find in the same inventory record a Rose and an Ashley in the same place. And I didn't do that. But then I thought, well, perhaps they were simply owned by the same person and were linked in that way, but they could have been in different estate bundles. And that's what I found in the actually in the Charleston inventory, which is a special document that was fortuitously copied before the Civil War because the original records were destroyed in a fire during the Civil War. On one page, I find a Rose who was owned by a very prominent Charleston merchant, Robert Martin, one of the wealthiest men in Charleston, who left behind one of the most palatial mansions well known in the city. And 100 miles away, this is in a separate set of documents on different pages, were about the names of about 100 slaves whom he owned when he died in 1852. And one of those was the child Ashley. And seeing that they were owned, Rose and Ashley were owned, and then that the estate had to be divided up to raise a lot of money for Robert Martin's white heirs, that put us on the trail.
I know that this is your work. You look into the history of slavery in the United States, but there's also something very compelling and moving about the idea of combing through estate records to learn about what happened to people, to learn about what happened to a mother and her child. What was that? What was
right.
that like?
I think so. I think you're absolutely right. Of course, there's a professional side. I teach. I direct a museum. I spend a lot of time studying objects. But this is different. It seemed like a profound personal and ethical responsibility. we teach our students so often. We study the history of the 4 million enslaved people who were owned, who were human property in 1860 when Lincoln was elected at the beginning of the Civil War. But beyond all those numbers and beyond the staggering wealth that was associated with the slavery system is this profoundly personal story. And, you know, in the middle of this, I began to remember a rabbi who had said in reference to 9/11, you know, it wasn't that 3,000 people died on that day. A person died 3,000 times. And this object gave us the opportunity to honor those specific people, not just the numbers, not just the thousands, the millions, but to honor a very specific story of a mother and a child who were separated. And getting the details right just seemed so important. And it did start to obsess me, I think, over this last year. That's right.
I wonder how often you thought about Ruth Middleton when you were searching for Rose and Ashley and what happened to them. I mean, all Ruth knew about her ancestors were that one of them was sold as a child and separated from her mother. And mm-hmm. she was able to put that on this sack. How often did you think of her and what she didn't know about her family as you searched for
them? I was so fascinated that she had done that. We have so many amazing oral stories that have come down in African-American history, of course, stories of slavery that were transmitted. But it's very rare that they're written down, and I don't know of any case in which they were written down in needlework in this particular way. And so I was always wondering, well, why would she do that? Why would this story that had come down for perhaps 80 or 90 years orally, why did she feel the need to write it down? But once we were able to figure out who Ruth Middleton was, when I found her marriage certificate in the Philadelphia City Hall, and I realized that she'd probably been pregnant when she was getting married and that her husband had soon after abandoned her. So that means that in 1921, she was a single mother raising a two-year-old girl up in Philadelphia probably very difficult to reduce circumstances. And now we can at least imagine a scenario. She was telling the story to her little girl, but it wasn't the way that maybe her mother had told her the story back in South Carolina. Now they were in a different place. And something about coming north, being in this new, exciting, but challenging world meant that it wasn't just enough to tell the story surrounded by many relatives, but just mother and daughter. And at that point, she decided to translate, it would seem, the oral story into something written. And she wrote it very beautifully with a great literary skill, I must say. Beautiful needlework, beautiful handwriting, but also just a wonderful way in 54 words of conveying this story. And I could even read those words if you would like that.
I was just going to ask. I had an inkling that you might have them memorized because there's only 54, but if you have them, I'd love to hear it.
My great-grandmother Rose, mother of Ashley, gave her this sack when she was sold at age 9 in South Carolina. It held a tattered dress, 3 handfuls of pecans, a braid of Rose's hair. Told her, "It be filled with my love, always." She never saw her again. Ashley is my grandmother, Ruth Middleton, 1921. So that's all we have of this amazing story, are those 54 words. But so much is packed into them. And the more you read it and think about those words, and she's done it in different colors, very carefully designed. And the largest line in red is, "It be filled with my love always." And the word love comes in the exact center of the needlework, so that it just in large letters fills all this. And for many African-American older women in South Carolina, the moment they see this, they begin to cry. And they say, well, this reminds us of the words of Jesus in the Bible, always in red. And that, they feel, is what sort of woke up the bag. For many of them feel the bag is a sacred object, what they would call kanjo or mojo or obia, a sacred African-influenced tradition of a bag that carries medicine, and that it has to be woken up. And that line, "It be filled with my love always," it just reduces everyone to tears. It's all she could give were those objects and her love, but that the bag became a sort of protective talisman is how they think about it.
You've obviously seen the bag as well, yes?
I have. It's beautifully installed at the new Smithsonian National Museum of African American History and Culture. And I was there for the the Scholars opening, and it was very exciting. The curators have really done an amazing job. It was beautifully installed at Middleton Place down in South Carolina, but now it's, of course, a national treasure, and it's really in the heart of the new Smithsonian Slavery and Freedom Concourse, which is the first thing you do see when you go into the museum. Just opposite the words of Thomas Jefferson and all the paradoxes of liberty, it's next to a big installation of an actual slave auction block with a lot of information about the millions and millions of dollars that were bound up in enslaved people. And then just next to it is this very quiet installation of the bag that reminds us of the personal, the human aspects of slavery. It wasn't just a financial and a political system. It meant these sort of human horrors. But it does more than that. I think when you see it, and the way that it's been displayed is you see the whole seed sack, and then at the bottom you see that it's embroidered. And it reminds you of something important, which is that we often think of slavery in terms of suffering, but we have to remember the narratives of resilience, of courage, and of family continuity. You can't imagine a family being more terribly torn apart than by a slave auction of a 9-year-old little girl. But this family story continued. And I think that's the amazing thing. When you see it in the museum or when you're able to get close to it and you think, well, Ashley and Rose, they were separated by the slave sale. There's Ruth Middleton, one of their descendants, who's separated by a great deal of geography. But they're all together on this sack. And I think that's what makes it, to my mind, a national treasure, because it reminds us that of all the terrible things that we can do to one another in the human family, a family does endure. And that's a very important lesson, especially at a very uncertain historical moment like we find ourselves now, where nobody knows really what's coming, especially in terms of issues of diversity and equal justice under law and so forth, to be reminded of the extraordinary strength and courage of this line of women of color, who pass on this gift of storytelling. And then Ruth Middleton, as probably a 19-year-old single mother, is able to translate it into this beautiful story, not made for public consumption, then it's lost for all these years. And then it turns up unexpectedly in 2007. It turns up in a flea market, and that's how it was finally given to Middleton Place and then came to the Smithsonian. So it's a sort of miraculous story, many wild coincidences, but it does remind us of this extraordinary continuity of the family. It's a story of lineage, and that's an important story for us all to remember right now.
You described what it was like watching women of color look at that embroidery and see the word love centered in the embroidery. What was it like for you to realize that that was the word that your eye was drawn to by design? That's how Ruth Middleton designed
right.
it.
Yes. I mean, it does sweep you away. You sort of move from being the, quote, rational or objective scholar at the moment like that, when you really think of that terrible separation. I mean, everybody brings to a museum, to an object, their own stories. I immediately began to think of the story of my own great-grandparents who were lost in the Holocaust, and how I've tried, you know, over the years with other members of my family to trace exactly what happened to them in the killing fields of what's now the Ukraine, where they were taken by the Romanian fascists in collaboration with the Nazis. And I think that that's part of what drives a lot of us who work on these stories of terrible of slavery and suffering, is a desire to do right by those who were lost. So whether or not it's the Holocaust or stories of contemporary genocide or of long ago suffering, it's important for us all to have these difficult conversations, because when you look into that word and see love and think of the loss, but also of that triumph of a literary and artistic sense that's in a concentrated way capturing this story, it holds up a mirror to all of us. And that's a very important thing.
Mark Auslander is an associate professor of anthropology at Central Washington University and director of the university's Museum of Culture and Environment. The cloth sack is now on display at the Smithsonian in Washington, D.C., and we're tweeting out a photo of the sack now. That's at KUOW.